Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
This has got to be the saddest day of my life. I called you here today for a bit of bad news. I won't be able to see you anymore because of my obligations and the ties that you have. We've been meeting here every day. And since this is our last day together, I want to hold you just one more time. When you turn and walk away, don't look back. I want to remember you just like this. Let's just kiss and say goodbye.
To meet you here today, there's just so many things to say. Please don't stop me till I'm through. This is something I hate to do.
GD, welcome to Street Player Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Thursday, the 12th of June, 2014. The time is 1:30 p.m. We just heard Kiss and Say Goodbye, as recorded by the Manhattans. legends of R&B soul who have earned their share of gold and platinum along the way. I'll be featuring more songs a little later during the interview. We also lost another of our great guests, our great talents today. The Ruby Dee passed away today, and I send out my prayers to her family and friends around the globe. I so cherish the pioneers that have paved the way for us. Rest in peace, Ruby Dee, and thank you for your entertainment contribution to the industry. The heart and soul of a legendary group transcends changes in the lineup by keeping the rich core sound crisp, clear, and meaningful. The Manhattans have certainly established an individual sound all their own with such hits as Shining Star, Kiss and Say Goodbye, There's No Me Without You, and countless others. The musical backdrop that they've played in our lives taps into a well of emotion that corresponds with the beat of our hearts and parallels the rush of feelings that race throughout our mental being. Great songs are made greater by the singers who sing them. And today, we have one of the best in the business joining me here on A Touch of Grace. His name is Gerald Austin. Gerald, welcome to A Touch of Grace. How are you doing on this beautiful June day?
I'm doing fine. And yourself?
You know what? I'm doing pretty good, pretty good, just absorbing the sunshine. So I want to thank you for being on the show today. It is an honor to have you here with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so what's been keeping you busy these days, my friend?
Well, we've been touring. I'm in the process of completing a gospel album. In fact, I just released a single titled Back to Basics, the gospel record, gospel CD. And I just also released a four-song EP with four gospel songs on it, including Back to Basics. And I'm still working with the Manhattans, and we are heading out to St. Thomas very early in the morning.
Wow. Well, it's even greater to know that you took time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. So you're headed out to the Caribbean islands, huh?
Oh, yeah. I'm ready, too.
I hear you. I hear you. So I guess let's start at the beginning. As a young lad, did you have any idea that stage would become an integral part of your life?
You know, it happened. I didn't really think it would at one time, but I knew I wanted to sing at an early age. And then as I got older, I realized that my Uncle Johnny Field was a founding member of the Five Blind Boys of Alabama. My father singing, my mother was singing, and my mother had a group with my father's sisters, and they had a group, and then my father had a group with his uncles and his brother, and so I think it was destined. And as I grew older, I started singing, and with my cousin Dwight, and then we formed a group called the Gerald Austin and the New Imperials. And we sang in clubs and fraternities, frat houses on the weekend and on Saturday, Friday and Saturday. And then on Sunday, we were at a gospel jubilee, and we would sing in church.
Wow.
And that lasted up until I joined the Manhattans in 1970.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your youth, and we're going to get into all of those wonderful things. You definitely have musical roots within you. You mentioned the Five Blind Boys of Alabama. So can you tell us where you spent your youth and about a fond memory that you still remember to this day growing up there?
Well, I grew up in North Carolina. My grandparents raised me, and I grew up in Henderson, North Carolina. And I think one of my fondest memories was I did my first talent show. And I was in elementary school, and my principal was Mr. Williams, Sanford E. Williams, and he was very strict. He was a nice gentleman, but he was very strict, and he didn't allow you to miss class for anything unless you were sick, you know, something like that. And I remember I was in class. I was in the sixth grade, and I was in class, and one of the high school teachers sent for me, and they sent a note to Mr. Williams requesting I leave school. I got out at 3:10, and they called, requested me to come over about 2:00. and Mr. Williams let me go. And fortunately, the teacher that sent the note, he knew her very well. They were neighbors. And she wanted me to sing on a talent show. And I remember he allowed me to go. And I sang Tennessee Waltz, Sam Cooke's version of Tennessee Waltz. And I won the talent show, standing ovation, and the rest was history. I was singing all over. And that was one of my fondest memories because I knew how strict Mr. Williams was about education. And he did not allow you to do extracurricular activities that would take you away from your education. And he allowed me to do it.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you right now that educators definitely are a different breed than they were back then. And education is such a crucial part of our development. So it's great that you had somebody behind you that actually kept you on track. And so let's talk about that talent show. So were you nervous when you did the talent show?
I was very nervous. And the teacher, the instructor that called me, her name was Mrs. Gladys Darensberg. And she later became my English teacher in junior high and, junior high school. And plus, she knew my family and all. I was from a small town. But anyway, she I got over there, and she told me what she wanted, and I sang on the talent show that night. And it was unbelievable. I remember I sang the song. I was standing in ovation. Everybody hollered and screaming. And then they said, "We want more." And that was the only song I knew and learned for that show. So we had to do it again. And when Jimmy started playing the piano, I couldn't hear the pitch. And I couldn't get the right key. So he started singing it. Then I got the pitch and I sung it. And it was all over again. And from then on out, I was allowed to do the talent shows, Mr. Williams, whenever our school had homecoming. I was only at another year. I was in the sixth grade, sixth and seventh grade. And the next year when they had homecoming, which I was in the seventh grade because I did that in the sixth grade, he allowed me to go over and practice again the next year. And then the following year, I was in the eighth grade, and I was going to Henderson Institute, which was the high school. The high school and middle school was together. And so Ms. Darensberg was there, so I had no problem with getting out of class, but I had to make sure I was on it. Now, if my grades hadn't been good, I couldn't perform in a talent show. Mm-hmm. And they already had made that unknown to me. If I wasn't doing well in my studies, I could not get out to do the talent show. So,
I have to say that them sticking by their guns pushed you towards excellence. So, I could easily see you being definitely steadfast on your homework to actually be a part of the beginning of your career, because that's exactly what it was. So, were the schools segregated during that time?
They were doing the trials where they had one or two African-American students going to the white schools. We had integrated teachers. We had a couple of white teachers at our schools, but it wasn't that going. It was the other way. It wasn't happening. So when I graduated in 1970, that's when all the schools integrated, and they closed by our elementary school. Well, they didn't close it, but they combined it and changed the name. And they closed my high school because they wanted all the kids to go to the other schools. And that's when integration took in the 70s. But it happened the year after I graduated.
So in your school then, your grammar school, because that was like right up to the eighth grade, so you were primarily African-American, is that correct?
It was all African-American.
Okay.
To sixth grade, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so by the time you got into high school, what was the racial climate like, and how did you continue to grow yourself as an artist?
Well, you know, we formed a band while I was in high school, and it was an interracial, it was a mixed band, and it's so funny, the guy that played drums for us initially, he did not like black people.
Oh.
And that was the way he was raised. But he never showed it. I found out When I found out about it, we had stopped singing. I was on my own with Manhattan. And he told one of the former members that he wasn't, you know, but he didn't care for black people. You know, he didn't have, he was just taught that. He had no, he couldn't tell him why, but he just didn't. That's the way he was raised. And he said, after we started playing, he realized that we were people just like him. Mm-hmm. And we all became, our band became very close. And we worked together. We stayed in hotels together. When we couldn't afford everybody's room, we all slept in the same room together, you know, on the floor, on the chair, anywhere. But we worked together and we stayed together up until I got into 12th grade. And some of our guys left. And then I met Manhattan in my 12th grade year. I graduated in 70. I met the Manhattan right after I graduated. And that's mm-hmm. when I left the group and started singing with the Manhattan.
I see, because the Manhattans have been very successful in the industry, but you were also part of another group that you had mentioned a little earlier, the New Imperials. So were the New Imperials ever signed to a label?
No, but we were like the number one soul group in the state of North Carolina.
Wow.
We played all over North and South Carolina, and we made top dollar as an amateur
group.
Wow.
That's amazing. And what... Mm-hmm.
Good. What was you about to say?
I was going to ask, what was one of the New Imperial songs?
Well, we never recorded. We did record it. But it was never released. And we did a song called Love is the Same All Over. Love's the Same All Over. And the gentleman that produced it at the time was the musical director for Aretha Franklin. And,
oh, wow.
He got lost in the wash, mixed in the wash, contractual issues. We had a management that wasn't really in our corner. They were in for themselves. And our parents said, oh, no, you cannot sign with them. And that was in them.
Wow. Okay, so how long from the Imperials did it take to get you to the Manhattans?
Well, I was with Imperials. Well, when I met the Manhattans, the group had kind of dwindled down. It was just me and my cousin Dwight and a young lady by the name of Carol Towns. We were singing together. Mm-hmm. The other guys had gone away to school and started doing something different. And when I met the Manhattans, they needed a sound system that they were performing at the college that I had just enrolled in. Central College, and they needed a sound system. So I had my professor asked me to use mine, and I was singing, and they heard me sing. And I remember Richie Blue, the manager, and a guy named Phil Terrell came in, Phil Flood, and he walked in, and Richie said, man, this is a godsend. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And so they asked me to sing on the show, and then after the show, I went home and changed clothes. I sang on the show. And then I found out that the original lead singer was sick. He was there, but he was very ill. And Philip Flood was Blue's cousin. He was traveling with the group, singing with them, just in case George got sick. And unfortunately, George got very sick after he left my college. Mm-hmm. And they had taken my name and address, and they flew me down to Dallas, Texas, and I watched the Manhattans perform with the Supremes for 10 days. And then we came back to New York and rehearsed, and the rest was history.
Wow. So they were performing with the Supremes. Amazing.
Yeah.
So when I'm thinking, in listening to your life, it sounds to me like just music has just always been a part of you. I mean, here you were in grade school, and you were actually getting standing ovations. So by the time you made it there into the mainstream, was your confidence level where it was going to be, or did it take time to build up to that confidence to sing with a group like the Manhattans?
Well, you know, when I met the Manhattans, it was just like the group I had just left. Because I'd sang in a group before, and I knew the issues about personalities and things like that, you know, and how we had to work together for the group. And when I joined the Manhattans, it was like just a transfer from one group to the other. And the guys were down home, you know, and they taught me a lot. And they even taught me even more about being group orientated. So we have to do what's best for the group and not what's best for an individual. And it was like stepping in the shoes, and it was I was a little nervous about it at first, but after I started singing, it was piece of cake.
Mm-hmm. And what do you remember about that first performance as a Manhattan?
My very first performance as a Manhattan was on the show with some it was a big show. My first show was in Richmond at the mosque. We were on the show with the Dells, the OJs, Kool and the Gang, Willie Feaston, the Mighty Magnificence, the Spinners, Patti LaBelle, and the Bluebells.
Wow.
And believe me, that was a hot show. And that was my first show. And I remember we had car problems, and it took us about 12 hours to drive to Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
And Richmond is a six-hour ride from New York. And when I got to Richmond, the Dells were on, getting ready to go on. And the promoter was not going to let us go on. And I'll never forget Marvin Jr. said, no, let them go on. They made it here. They late, but they made it here. Let them go on. And so we went on, and we sang. We got paid. And that was something that most artists wouldn't have done.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dells, when I met the Dells, they became like mentors, like the guys in the group. Up until, they always be my mentors. Even though Johnny has passed away, Marvin has passed away, the Dells will always be my mentors. Chuck, Mickey, and Vern.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that very well. They stood up for us.
Well, so the question that I have for you, Gerald, God, what an exciting time in your life. I mean, for someone who was born for this, I know that it definitely was easy to kind of like get into the moment because it was something that you were born to do. But the question that I have, how long did it take you to perfect your onstage persona?
It took me about... Let me see. I would say truly about a year. And and when I first started, the guys used to wouldn't say anything. They just coached me to adjust it by stage presence. But I was trying to sing like Sam Cooke and George Smith a little. And so what happened was, unfortunately, we had a guy in a group named Richard. And Richard is no longer with us. He passed away in 87. And Richie came to me one night after we had been working a while. He said, Gerald, he said, you've been here long enough. It's time for you to be yourself. He said, you shouldn't be George Smith. You shouldn't be Sam Cooke. You should be Gerald Austin. He said, now it's time for you to make the show. And all the songs I sang at that time were George Smith. So he said, now it's time for you to stop trying to sing like George Smith. It seemed like Gerald Austin. And then when I started, and I took his advice, and I started letting the songs grow to be a part of me. And when I did that, that's when the tide began to turn more and more, and we became more and more successful.
Yeah, because you really do have a distinct voice. As a matter of fact, there are a number of singers that I love. Gladys Knight is one of them, and I know Sam Cooke was definitely one, where when you sing, not only do you make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, it brings a tear to my eye. When did you know exactly the persona that you found being yours? When did you realize that you had found it?
Well, I realized it I felt it when I was in school. And when I joined the Manhattan, the confidence level got even higher.
Mm-hmm.
And that took me right to where I needed to go. And see, when I started, like I said, when I started singing, we were on a major show with big artists. So that put me in a place, where they kind of took me to another level.
Yeah, you know, you're also the nephew. You're also the nephew of Shirley Alston Reeves, who sang with the Shirelles. So, did she ever give you any wisdom?
Well,
about,
you know, actually, Shirley and I are more or less like cousins. In some of the interviews and stuff, they got mixed up. And Shirley's from the same hometown. Shirley's mother used to live behind us as a child and growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I, and as we grew older, you know, I worked together with Shirley in New York at the town hall. And we met on several occasions. We talked. She left when I was a little boy. And but yes, we've conversed and we've talked. And but when I talked to her, I was already in Manhattan and was working my thing. But I would always take advice from anybody who had some good advice. I even accept criticisms. I didn't like them all the time, but I would listen to them because in the middle of that criticism, that person might have been right.
Mm-hmm.
I might have had some what I call jewels down in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hold on 1 second. I know we're on the radio. Please hold on 1 second.
I sure will. All right. So those of you who have tuned in today, I am having an intriguing interview with Gerald Alston of the Manhattans. Hey, Gerald, are you back with us?
I'm back with you.
All right. So what I would like to do right now is I've got a surprise for you today. My friend over at World Media told me that you would love this one. So we're going to have a music break. So after the music break, we're going to come back and complete the interview. But I want to go ahead and play a song that you sang by someone you admired. And so it's called A Change Is Gonna Come. How did you go about recording that? Did you talk to Sam and tell him you wanted to record his song?
No, when Sam died, Sam was my mentor. And when he died, it was like it just destroyed me. And that song was a song that I sang in a talent show. And people were crying. I mean, they were so excited about it. And then I went to the Apollo Theater in 66, and with that song, I won 4 weeks amateur hour at the Apollo Theater.
Wow.
And I won a week there, and I was on the show with Johnny Taylor, Sidney Shells, and Clarence Carter, and I was going to sing something else. But the Reuben Phillips, and what's his name? Oh, God, I can't call his name. He was at the Apollo. And he told me, no, you sing this same song, Honeycomb.
Mm-hmm.
And Honeycomb told me to sing the same song that I won with. And I sang that same song with the big orchestra. And we recorded it in early 70s, but the production wasn't good. And so when I came back, I later wanted to do a tribute album to Sam Cooke. And I got with a friend of mine, Travis Milner, who produced part of my gospel album, and he produced Sam Cooke tribute album. And he did a great job of it, and he did the arrangement and production on A Change Is Gonna Come. And I also did a live version, and I did a recorded version. And I've always wanted to do that song. And then we continue to do it today, even till today, and people love it.
All right. All right, well, for those who have tuned in today, we are talking to one of the legends in R&B. His name is Gerald Alston. We are about to listen to A Change Is Gonna Come, so kick back and relax and listen to the sultry sounds of Gerald Alston singing A Change Is Gonna Come.
Just
like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change.
Show with Sam Cooke, and he said it was nothing like it.
He said it was unbelievable how that man performed on stage. He had charisma. The audience that he held in the palm of his hand, and he just had it going on. And when I look back at history, I started the same age that Sam Cooke started, singing with Soul Sisters. I started singing with the Manhattans. On top of which, when I joined the Manhattans in 1970, I was offered a job to sing lead for the Soul Sisters, and I already signed a contract with the Manhattans.
Mm-hmm. And so, thank you for clearing that up for me. I know that Change Is Gonna Come is one of those R&B classics that, again, like you said, some people get into the studio and they try to oversing the song or work it with a different arrangement. But I love what you did with the song. So what was it like recording that? Did you have any emotions that were stirring in you as you were singing the words of someone that you admired so long?
Oh, yeah. It was a wonderful feeling. It was a wonderful feeling to know that I had been able to give an opportunity. When the interview is over, if you give me a mailing address, I will mail you the tribute album with the version I did in 08 of Sam Cooke's Change Is Gonna Come and more of his songs. This song, the version you just played, I did that in 1970-71. And I have to take it back. I said the production wasn't that good, but that production was good. It was different arrangement, but that was listening at it in hindsight, it was a great production. It was a very good production. We just didn't get the play that we wanted on it.
I hear you.
The production was good.
Well, I thank you for covering that song because it is one of my favorites. So in your honest opinion, what makes a good song, Gerald? How do you know a good song when you see it or hear it?
First of all, a good song tells a great story. And I'm going to tell you a little something. This August 16th, the Manhattans will be celebrating 53 years.
Wow.
And our songs that we recorded back in the 60s and the 70s sound just as good today as they did back then. Now, this is what I'm coming up to. And the reason they do is because that we wrote songs that people could identify with. We wrote songs that people could relate to in their lives, you know, as a part of, wow, that song, I remember where I was when this song happened, when this song was written. I remember this. I remember that about the song. The song played a very integral part in people's lives. We wrote songs that people knew that things happened in their lives. It was real. Unlike some of the songs today, they're just a hook. They don't really have a deep story. Now, I must admit, songs coming back around to that kind of writing again. But that's what made great songs for us, because There's No Me Without You. It itself tells a story. Kiss and Say Goodbye. Okay? Shining Star. You know, It Feels So Good to Be Loved So Bad. You know, those songs like that, we never danced to a love song. These songs tell stories about things that happen. You know, and like We Never Danced a Love Song was a song about disco era. And, you know, me and my lady, we was hanging out. We always went out. Every time I was out of disco. So We Never Danced a Love Song. And that's why I wrote a song about it. It started out as a up-tempo tune, and then it slowed down. Come on, baby, let's sit down. We've been dancing all night long. And it was we want to dance a love song.
Wow. That's how you could tell a true artist, is because you guys will just do it on the spot. You'll just do it on the spot and you'll sing. So that's going to be a treat for the people who tuned in today. So let's talk about Shining Star. Shining Star earned the Manhattans a Grammy. Do you remember that moment when you first heard that you had been nominated for a Grammy?
Yes, I do. It was when we were told that we were nominated for a Grammy. We were up against Commodores, Gladys Knight, the Jacksons, and the Spinners. So we said, okay, we just been nominated, but that's good. We, you know, among some of the best. So we wasn't expect. We really did not expect to win. And that night, sitting there in Radio City, and when they said the best group of duo, after they call all the names, they said goes to the Manhattans. It was like we all looked at each other like, oh no, this didn't happen. And we did our own stars, you know. And but it was fortunately for us, it was our time. It was our time. And but I remember being nominated. We, you know, like, it was like, yeah, okay, we nominated, but we were some heavy hitters. We're not going to get this. And bless God, there it was.
Yeah. And so what did being – well, let me ask you a question. So after you went on stage and you got your Grammys, what was that night like for you guys?
That night was like floating on a cloud.
Mm.
It was like we just were lifted up and we just floated on a cloud. You know, unbelievable. We worked hard and we wanted that. And we were blessed with it, you know. We were blessed with it.
Yeah. Right, right. And so what did being acknowledged by the Grammy Association do for the spirit of the group?
It did a lot for the spirit of the group, and our work schedule got bigger. Our price went up, you know. But as for soul artists, it is bad to say this, but you're only good as your last record. And
that's right.
When the height of the Grammy went down, our career started descending.
Wow.
And we had a couple of records afterwards, but we never made it back to that point again.
Mm.
And the music started changing. It really started changing. And when the music started changing, that was a beginning point of the we were old timers.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a CD out in 1989 titled Even Now. And when it was released, several people, I had many of my fans to tell me that they saw it in the record store. And they had a brand new album on the Manhattan in the record store. It was in the Oldie But Goodie bin.
Hmm.
It was not up with the – some stores had it with the new CDs, but a lot of them had it in the Oldie But Goodie bin. And a lot of radio stations wouldn't play it because they said we were too old and the young audience didn't want to hear it. And it was a lie because the young artists wanted to hear it. And had the young audience been given a chance to hear our music, Adele's music, the Dramatics music, Ray Goodman and Brown as a constant. You know, we know music changed and we had to change with times, but had they been able to hear that music and listen to it, they would have carried it on. And their music today would still have that same substance. And they would be long lasting. They wouldn't be like, for instance, now. It's truly an artist is just as good as his last record. Because if an artist can sell 10 million records now, they sell much more than we sold. They sell 10 million now and come back and sell 3 million, that's a flop for them. And they're dropped by the record company. They are dropped. Whereas we may have sold 1 million records and came back and sold 300,000 or 500,000. We got pushed again. We started all over again, but we got the push to try. We got another chance to try it again. Today, you don't get that chance.
Yeah, you know what you like is I like when the younger artists like Alicia Keys, I had Billy Brown from Ray Goodman and Brown on, and she actually tapped them to sing background on You Don't Know My Name. And let's face it, you know and I know, especially as a consummate entertainer, that and like you mentioned, radio was saying that you were too old. But you know what? That's really not what it is. That's just somebody else pushing their own agenda. So the question
exactly.
I ask for you, since you guys are still performing, like you said at the beginning, you guys are going to be in the Caribbean tomorrow. I wish I was there to cheer you guys on. But when you look out into the crowds, Gerald, what nationalities do you see attending your concerts?
Well, now we play. It's a mixed crowd. Sometimes we play certain areas that's predominantly black. Then we'll play like Star Plaza in Maryville, Indiana. We get a mixed audience. and we toured with B.B. King and Bob, the late Bobby Bland. The audience was mixed, and they knew all of our songs. They knew all of our songs. We played South Africa. It was majority, well, naturally it was majority black, but we played Japan. And we played, like, in Texas, and we played in the States where the audience was mixed. A lot of times in the Midwest, our audience is mixed. And sometimes
and you mentioned
sometimes it's like 60-40. We'll be 60% white, excuse the expression, and 40% black. So it varies.
So, so the question that I have for you, because thank you for because I was going to ask you that question. Audiences abroad. So you've been over in Japan. What was that reception like for you guys?
Unbelievable. And a lot in Japan, it's funny that a lot of our Japanese fans don't speak English, but they know every word to every song that we sing.
Wow.
And through a translator, they will tell you if you mess it up. They will tell you if you make a mistake in the lyrics. And I remember going to Japan, Mr. Ono, a promoter by the name of Mr. Ono, he took us over, and he did a nice booklet. And in the booklet, we had our show, and he had the lyrics to all the songs in the show. We had in the book. And you can see a lot of the fans reading along with us.
I've all the concerts that I've gone through, I know about the little tour books, but I've never had one that actually had the lyrics in it. So, wow, what a reception, Japan. Amazing. So I have a question about the name The Manhattans. Who came up with the name The Manhattans? Is there any significance about a city?
Yeah.
I think, what, Manhattan? Yeah.
Well, actually, the Manhattans name originated from the drink, the Manhattan. And what happened, we became advocates of no drinking and no drugs, and so we decided, we realized that that wasn't a good metaphor for our name. So what we did, we decided to change the name as a city of Manhattan. And then we took it from there, and for the past 40, almost 50 years, it's been the skyline of New York.
That's fantastic. And when you were talking about drinking and drugs, how did you avoid the pitfalls of the business, Gerald?
You know something? It was there for everybody. I think I can't speak for nobody else, but I was able to get a taste of all of it. But you know what happened? There were people in my life, personal life, and members in the group who stood by each. We stood by each other, and we said, "No, we can't let you do that." You know, and you know, we all at I think at a certain point in career, everybody drank and hung out and had a good time. But it get to a point. It got to a point that we began to grow and realize that this is what we worked for. We worked to be where we were, where we are now. And to destroy it with drugs and alcohol was terrible.
Yeah, it is. And we know that know that we've lost a lot of greats, like, you know, David Ruffin, you know, and his story with substance abuse, and Rick James, and, you know, the list goes on. And in that industry, there are, if you want it, there are people that actually will make sure that you have it. So I'm just so glad that you guys know enough to stay away. And we're surrounded with the right type of people, because I look at the late Michael Jackson and see that the people were around him that did not have his best interest at heart. But let's talk about your solo career. You left to pursue a solo career for a while. What was that experience like for you without the group being on stage?
It was frightening, because being on stage with a group, everybody, when the fans were coming to see the show, they saw four people, and originally it was five, but they saw four people on stage, and so the eyes just wasn't on the lead singer. But when I started singing as a solo artist, all eyes were on me, and I had to carry that show. And eventually I got used to it, but it was a little bit nerve-wracking at first. And, you know, I realized as a solo artist that I would always be a Manhattan first. You know, and people remembered me as lead singer of the Manhattans. And they appreciated my solo songs, my solo career. And but I always could never leave the stage without singing Kiss and Say Goodbye, A Shining Star, or A Medley of the Manhattan. I always had to do that, which was good for me. But it was those 6 years were some of the best years of my life as an artist.
All right. All right.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite song to perform, the one that audiences ask for?
Wow. I think one of the biggest songs, especially in the South, believe it or not, other than Kiss and Say Goodbye and Shine and Star, is We Never Danced to a Love Song.
Ah.
Yeah, down south, We Never Danced a Love Song. It was never released as a single, but it was the biggest song you could think of down in the South. And it feels so good to be loved so bad.
Okay.
That's my favorite. My favorite was There's No Me Without You.
There's No Me Without You. Who wrote that one?
That was written by Sonny Bivens, Edward Bivens.
Without You. Okay, so just a question. Okay, so that's one of your favorites. Why is it your favorite? What do you like about it?
Because it told a story. Again, we go back. First of all, when I joined the Manhattans, and we went to our first international convention in San Francisco, it was the CBS International Convention. The theme for the convention was, There's No Me Without You. And we performed in San Francisco, and we used the orchestra. And that was the theme of the convention. And we sang that song, the response was wonderful. And it was true. And the song is a love song where Sonny wrote telling the person that he loved, he or she, that, you know, that the song had been sung to. There's no me without you. I'm everything because of you. And if we took that same attitude and started Mickey Irison over at Columbia Records. He was the president of R&B music, R&B department, and it was the same thing. There's no me without you. We wouldn't exist as the Manhattans without our fans.
All right.
And that was a song that we did for our fans because that song paid tribute to our fans, you know, because our fans always, even to this day, and I say it, they do us a favor by coming to listen to us sing. We don't do them a favor by performing for them. So we humble ourselves and give ourselves as service to our fans. And it's the truth. There's no me without you. We would not be the Manhattans. We wouldn't have 53 years of singing without our fans.
Well, I just want to say congratulations on those 53 years. And we, as fans of your music, are made more because of the sacrifices that you've actually made. So who are the current members of the Manhattans with you today?
Okay, right now, the current members are Blue Lovett. He's an original member. As you know, I replaced George Smith. I've been there so long, so I'm going to say I'm an original. And then we have Troy May. And we also have Dave Tyson. And Dave Tyson is the brother of Ron Tyson of the Temptations. And we had some fun with that. Whenever we work with the Temptations, we always have fun with that. So, but those are the actual members of the group right now.
Well, again, I just want to say on behalf of the Touch of Grace, thank you so much for bringing good music to us still to this day, 53 years later. Still bringing the great music to us. And so the final questions are, how do you maintain the energy to perform? I know you love the fans. How do you maintain that energy night after night after night, performing those songs night after night after night? How do you maintain that energy?
First of all, because I put God first.
All right.
Second of all, because I love it. And I've been singing these songs, some of these songs, for 40 years. But when I walk on that stage and see my fans out there and see the look in their face and the joy, I just reach down and get something. And then the adrenaline starts flowing and it just comes out. There are some nights when I'm tired and I don't feel like it. But I would say 95% of the time we're on, and it's on is because we get that adrenaline from our audience. Mm-hmm. We can, our fans give us that push to go out there, to do everything we can to satisfy them.
All right, and satisfy them you are. So I know that you're currently working on and releasing a gospel CD. So where can your music be purchased, Gerald?
Okay, right now I have an EP, a gospel EP, and it's titled Back to Basics. You can get that at my email at my website, GeraldAlstonMusic.com. And that's my website. And you can go to my website. You can order the Sam Cooke CD, the tribute to Sam Cooke, and you can order the gospel CD, Back to Basics. The gospel CD, Back to Basics, it's not on CD Baby, but you can get it from my website and do it through PayPal. And but the Sam Cooke CD is through my website and CD Baby.
Okay, that sounds great. So that we can go ahead and support the music that you're still continuing to bring to the world. And so for booking, if somebody wants to book the Manhattans, who do they call? Or is there an email?
Well, we're booked by two agencies. We're not exclusive with either one. Most of the South we're booked through Rogers Redding and Associates, and we're also booked through Winnicott Monica, which is out mm-hmm. of New York. And okay. I'm trying to pull up a number that I can give you for both of them. Winnicott Monica is 914-631-6500. And Rogers Redding Associates, I'm getting that for you right now.
Okay.
That number is, Rogers Redding and Associates is 478-742-8771.
All right. So
you
have
can call. Yeah, you can ask for Rogers Redding at his at the Macon, Georgia office, which is the 478 number, and Winnie for
mm-hmm.
Monica. You can ask for Paula Monica or Jody Winnie.
Okay, sounds great. Definitely wanted to get that out there because, again, I could just see people after the show wanting to have you perform at whatever the venue is there. People appreciate good music, Gerald, and I'm just so honored to have had a legend like you on my show, and I'll always be a promoter of your music. So you have just been interviewed on A Touch of Grace, and the question is, what is the best show on Block Talk Radio, Gerald?
A Touch of Grace.
All right.
Yes.
Well, thanks for doing the show, and have a safe journey over to the Caribbean, and I know that you're going to be fantastic. And I'll get World Media my address to get to you, because I didn't forget that you told me you were going to send me that Sam Cooke album.
And I'll send you the gospel one, too. Also, there's one other thing. I just want to give all my fans, the Manhattan's website is www.kissandsaygoodbye.com. Very simple. www.kissandsaygoodbye.com. And I also have a website. I have a Facebook page, and you just go to Gerald Alston on Facebook. And I also have a fan page. You can link from my Facebook page to the Facebook page of fans. So please check it out.
All right, and we most certainly will. I've actually been checking it out. So, Gerald, again, thanks for doing the show. I'm going to let you go ahead on with your afternoon. You and the fellas have a great show. Be safe, and God bless you. Welcome back here anytime. Just get in touch
Thank
with me,
so
and
much.
We'll do another show. You're welcome, Gerald.
You got
Take
it.
Care. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, I'm just amazed right now. I just got through talking to a legend, Gerald Alston of the Manhattan. What an amazing, amazing man. And I'm just glad that they're still out there making the music that we all love. I want to talk about some upcoming shows. On Friday the 13th, the Soul Singing Group, which is tomorrow, Split Image, joins me to discuss music. And I send thank yous to Yvette Brown at Extravagant Entertainment for making this interview possible with Split Image. On Saturday the 14th, this guy, I have to tell you. At 1:30 p.m., Jared Manios, author of Ghetto Plainsman, joins me to discuss his most recent books and his other endeavors, working as a green leader, a youth worker, a health advocate, as well as being a vegan athlete. So that should be a fantastic show. On Sunday, I've blocked it out. We are celebrating Father's Day 2014, so there will be no live shows. And again, my condolences to the family and fans of the late Ruby Dee, who passed away today. She was definitely a gem. Season 5 here on A Touch of Grace is only getting hotter, but it is all right to stand close because you know what? Getting burned feels so good. World Media, the bird that sits on my shoulder, the bluebird, thank you so much for making action happen as opposed to words, for bringing me great guests like Gerald Austin and Billy Brown of Ray Goodman and Brown and so many others. The final words that I have, you know what it's going to be. It's my favorite quote from the late wise Maya Angelou. Always remember this. When someone shows you who they are the first time, believe them. Rest well, dear Maya. Rest well. Thanks for tuning in, making A Touch of Grace, 40,000 strong and climbing. I'm going to go ahead and end the show with the Manhattan. It feels so good to be loved so bad. Thanks for tuning in.
Where you want me, and you know
again.
Do it once again.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace,
A Touch of Grace.
Literary Magic.
A Touch of Grace.
On Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.